Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. All right, folks, it is now or never, and welcome back. I have a really special program, or I should say show, for you this Friday. We're going to get into the design of our government and how it is so similar to the immune system of the body. One of the things that I think marvels science and marvels people today, and, you know, the complexity and the ability of our body to do all of these things. And so with that, we also wanted to tie into this. What we wanted to show you is, you know, I'll just say it at a high level, that there has been a long asserted effort. And you know, when somebody says that, you know, the knee bone is connected to the, you know, leg bone or what have you, and they go all the way up the line, or the head bone is connected to the neck bone and work down, however you want to work up or down the body, you know, starting at one point to the next, you know, there's always these connections. And so conspiracy theorists have to create these connections that, you know, really point out how, you know, there has been this design. The funny thing is, and the truth is, the American conspiracy theory is nothing that anybody can actually create all the connections to. And that's just because there are so many things that were in play and so many things that occurred that weren't directly associated to any foreknowledge or what have you. I'll just give you this case in point. I don't think when the federal government got involved in the railroad system that it was going to be essential as a part of the overall design of seizing control of our liberties. And there's no way you can connect some of these dots. But what we want to do is we're going to go through how the ratcheting of tyranny over the history of the United States has required two parties. In real context, when we look at the two-party system that we have, even though there was a changing of the names, there has always been a movement of big government and centralized government and central controls and distributive government and distributive controls and authority, that the local governments were the ones that were supposed to control everything, which means that's your counties, folks. When Thomas Jefferson referred to the United States' government and its system as distributive, to where the most of the decisions that would affect our lives the most would be the ones closest to us, well, that form of government is our counties. And over the years, it has been completely co-opted by the states, which, you know, following in suit, the federal government has been co-opting the states' authorities. And so we have lost our actual self-government and self-governing, which is supposed to be happening at our county. But what I want to do, and I'll get into this on Friday, tomorrow, and so I think you'll enjoy, you know, how this is laid out. And what we're going to do is we're going to show how the big government and the individual government are supposedly the, you know, those who supported individual liberty really turn their backs on us. And that, you've heard me say this before, the Republican Party that Jefferson and Madison created really started getting perverted when Madison stepped out, because the spirit of the party was really, and the essence of what this party was all about lived and was imbued by those two men, Jefferson and Madison. Now, Monroe was a good man. I really believe he was a good man, but he did some really bad and foul things. Say bad and foul together and be foul. Anyway, as my wife says, only I think I'm funny. My mother used to say that too. So, and did you get it from her? I don't know. But what I wanted to talk about for today, you know, to the message I really want to leave today, because I want to make sure you tune in tomorrow, because it's going to be special. What I think is an abomination is this concept of the freedom of speech for politicians. I believe that we, the people, have all of the rights. And I believe when you step into public service, you take on the role of sacrificing your personal opinions and feelings of some respects. Maybe not your belief system, but it's not about you anymore. When you become a public servant, it is about serving those who have placed you into service, right? And in a representative government, it's very well defined who you represent. But one of the things we've pointed out is that the true service of a public servant is the Constitution. In other words, your number one constituent as a public servant is not really those who elected you. Yeah, you're there representing them, but your primary representation, your primary responsibility is to that Constitution, which is why you take a legal oath that you must support that Constitution. Show me in the oath where you are legally bound to supporting your electorate, who your electorate may actually demand. We demand you give us money and give us benefits and give us jobs and give, give, give. That's not your job. Your job is to support the Constitution. And if the Constitution doesn't allow those things, then you can't do them. There's no such thing as a mandate in America. And I want you to understand this. But let me really focus on speech. Whenever a politician, whether they are a candidate or whether they are actually in office and on the campaign trail for re-election, or whether they are just driving an agenda while they're in office, anytime they say something, and I'll give you a case in point, climate change. When they start talking and flapping their gums about climate change, then they are dangerously close to demagoguery and invoking fear. And I truly believe, folks, I don't have the amendment, I don't have the language for this, but we need to make it illegal. We need to constrain politicians and throw them in jail. And actually, depending on the crime, depending on the magnitude of what they're trying to pull, it should be possibly even a capital offense. In other words, they be hanged. Because when somebody stands up, and I'll give you a good example, Gore. Go back and look at what Gore said. Gore told us by now we would, you know, our seaports would be flooded. Didn't he? Look at what he said. And when a politician makes an assertion, basically, when a politician wants to step into the realm of being a prophet, then I believe because they're entrusted, they're a part of the public trust, and they should not be lying for an agenda. They should not be trying to represent anything other than that Constitution. And so it's one thing for them to say, you know what, we need to have an amendment to the Constitution to allow us to control the environment so that we can avoid, you know, an all-time calamity. But for them to seize power and use demagoguery and fear to seize that power, first off, it's unconstitutional to do that. But to invoke fear, and this is why tomorrow's show you're going to love, but we want you to understand that our politicians, you know, when you step into that that be you. When you step up to that mantle of power, then you have to control yourself. You can't just yell fire in a movie theater without percussions or repercussions. I'm sorry. Anyway, what we really need to do is we need to start sending the messages that the freedom of speech ends when you want to step into a campaign, when you want to step into the fray of becoming a public servant. You're not a god. We don't have gods in politics in America. We do not have rulers. And what we have are public servants. And we have to maintain that context. Because most people think that, oh, you know, we make this guy, he's a god. He will feed us with manna from heaven. No. They will give us phones so we can talk. No. Folks, we really need to start holding public servants accountable for everything that comes out their mouth. Now, with that, as you know, the show is also sponsored by republicreview.org, and you're listening to the only show that gives you the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions. And so we're going to go into a break, and when we come back, what we're going to do is we are going to dive into the 17th Amendment. And maybe today we'll be able to cover the 17th, 18th, 19th, possibly the 20th, because some of these are pretty, you know, well, there's just not a lot to them. But the 17th, there is some stuff to get into, so we'll be right back after this.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and their 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their Constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what we have here is we have a 17th Amendment that actually Bill Bennett, to give you the background on this, Bill Bennett has come out and said that this particular amendment, along with the 16th Amendment, was questionably ratified. And so what ended up happening, I'll give you an example of one of these amendments that was passed. And as a matter of fact, I think Oregon was a dubious player in both of these, because both of these were floated out there. This one was actually floated out in 1912. And so there was an election in Oregon, and there was an election in many states. In 1912 was the election year. And so the election in Oregon and the ultimate campaign, because you got to look at this way, folks. Your state legislators are in session usually for just a couple of months, and that's usually the very first, the beginning of the year to take care of the year's business and put things in motion. They don't return to session until the following, usually January. Most all states begin their sessions in January, and they go till maybe March. And so when this amendment came out, the 17th Amendment came out, most of the states weren't in session. And so there were some states, because what it ended up happening, the 17th Amendment was supposedly, and this was a sleight of hand. There were several states at the time that started no longer sending senators because they were already co-opted by big government, and they wanted to pervert the Senate. In other words, big government had already seized control of the state legislatures. And so when this amendment came out, some of these state legislatures were actually taken back by the people, and the people elected legislators to actually not ratify this particular amendment, believe it or not. And in Oregon, they did not allow. So when the new session began in 1913, Oregon did not allow the new elected legislators to be seated until the old. So they actually called in those who were voted out and put them into session to say, basically, this amendment came in last year, and so this needs to be done by the old session before the new session takes over. And they literally pulled a fast one on the people of Oregon. And this is just one example that Bill Bennett points out to prove how this was unconstitutionally ratified. Because those people who actually ratified this, that gave enough of the votes to make this amendment pass in some of the states, well, those folks were not elected representatives anymore. So there's a lot of problems, but what we're going to do is we're going to go through the language of this amendment, and what we're going to prove here is that it really doesn't create any new powers, nor does it take any powers or sovereignty away from the states. And so what we want to do is we want to kind of go through this in some detail with you. And so this very first part deals with Section 1 or Article 1 of the Constitution. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators. And it's kind of interesting. They kind of have three parts of this, but there's no sections to it. So this, when I look at the amendments, because we just covered the 16th Amendment, when I look at the 16th and I look at the 17th Amendments, I actually believe that the people that wrote these amendments didn't understand the Constitution, and more so the 17th Amendment than the 16th. Because the 17th, to do this, there were some very specific things they needed to do to truly create a constitutional amendment, and they didn't, because you can't have conflicts. You can't put in a conflict in an amendment, or you can't pass an amendment. You can write it, but if you pass it and it creates a direct conflict with something else in the Constitution, then the amendment is suspect, and it actually should have been kicked back. The judges should have actually kicked that amendment back and said, hey, hold on here. This amendment does not deal with this, this, or this. And we'll get into that. So this is what it says. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state. Okay, there's no change there. Elected by the people thereof. That right there is the change. For 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. Now, when you look at that, and we talk about this, and I think we just kind of covered this in the last show as we started covering this, they point out that each senator has one vote, and they don't go to those details over representatives in the House of Representatives. And then they talk about the parameters for the electors. And it says, the electors in each state shall have the qualification requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures. Then the next part, and that's not a section, but the next paragraph or the next couple of sentences, when vacancies happen in the representation of any Senate or state in the Senate, the executive authority shall have such state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. Now, what this is doing, this is a change because this is bypassing completely the state legislature's suffrage in the Senate. Now, what do we mean by suffrage? Suffrage is a right to vote. And so when the people, do the people have a right to vote in issues in Congress? Yes, we have a right to vote. Our suffrage is based on our representatives in the House of Representatives. And so they are our suffrage. The people's suffrage is done in the House of Representatives. The state's suffrage is in the Senate. I want you to understand this because this is really important. It clearly states in Article 5 of the Constitution that no state shall lose their suffrage without their consent. And so, and we'll get into that, but I want to make sure that you understand this, that what they're talking about with the representation and this, you know, if a senator actually creates a vacancy, then what happens is it moves to the governor, to where the governor will actually create an election. See, prior to this, the state legislatures had full control, and they took care of it immediately. If a senator would, you know, created a vacancy, they would appoint or send one of their own up into the Senate, and they would then create a vacancy in the House of Representatives or in the state Senate and call for an election in the upcoming election year. Or, and the real process, the way most states do it today, is if a representative or senator in your state steps down, the party steps in and provides three choices. This is how it's done in Washington, and a lot of states follow this. They provide three choices to the governor, because I know Wyoming does this as well. And then the governor will pick one of the three. Now, the governor's not obligated, but 9 times out of 10, it's a part of politics. You play nice. And so the party, or I should say the seat that the party, that seat that representative had is controlled by the party they claimed. So what that means is that if you're a Republican, then it's the Republican Party that goes into an emergency session of that legislative district in the state, and then they come up with a list of nominees, and then the governor chooses out of that list who to fill that with from that party. So in other words, we the people don't have, and we don't have a Republican form of government. We have a party form of government, because it's the party that actually controls these seats. I just want you to understand this, because I've said this before, and this is another glimpse into how the party has its hooks in the system to where you have less of a voice, and that they make sure that those who they bless get those seats and they protect those people. As long as those people do the bidding necessary. I mean, there's no accountability. There is absolutely none. And 9 times out of 10, the direction for the local party by the state party is leave them alone, let them be. You know, it's already tough up there. They're making compromises, but they're doing good work for us. And they'll usually show you one nugget. Oh, well, they did this, even though they had to do all of these, you know, terrible compromises. This was really important. And if you've never heard that before, that's because you haven't been involved in the party, you know, at the county level, where you hear the state coming down, and basically your county chair, if he is a part of the establishment, will parrot those excuses to you, because It's about control. It's not about doing what's right. And so getting back to this, provided, okay, so going through the replacements of the vacancies, provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election as the legislature may direct. So here's the interesting thing. They still point out that the legislatures direct the election, how that is going to be done, right? And as a matter of fact, it is in concrete, it's in stone throughout the Constitution that the state legislatures are to control the election process for the state, the manner of how we choose electors and so forth. And so they keep that right there. They keep on supporting this. Today, we see Congress wanting to control the elections. We'll be right back after these 2 minutes.
As you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Well, folks, I've got some interesting and some sad news, and I'm going to be breaking just my train of thought on the 17th Amendment just shortly, real quick. I was just called by the founder, Chris Futrick, of Timber Nation, and you know, we support Timber Nation because they're a good constitutional company that believes in supporting the Constitution. Well, come to find out, they had just had a fire in their shop, and it was done by sabotage. And so all I can say is I hope, you know, first off, nobody was harmed, and they're moving things, and they're getting things realigned so that they can get back, you know, into production as quick as possible. But I'm just going to show to you that when it comes to the progressives, they don't care about the crime that they commit. They don't care about the harm. They don't care about their moral compass, you know, just spins around. They have no moral compass and guide. There's nothing steady that guides them other than evil. And so what I want to do is, if you are still looking, I'm going to do this plug real quick. If you're looking for quality hardwood furnishings, please reach out. please be patient and understand what they're doing. It's not like they're beaten here, but it's, you know, it's a good hit in the chin. And so hang in there, get your hardwood furnishings. You'll be very happy you did from Timber Nation. Okay. And put them in your prayers because, you know, when it comes to those who support the Constitution, we need every business out there to start recognizing that it is the Constitution and this system that allows small businesses to operate. It is the global Borg. It is the global movement of communism that wants all corporations to be controlled at a national or international level to where, you know, we basically just have a few that controls everything. And so that's what they're trying to do. I mean, that's why we get into the big government and centralized controls to distributive. And I don't want to say small government because the United States is not a small government, folks, by any stretch of the means. And we have all sorts of resources and all sorts of might. We could be far more powerful economically and technologically and in so many other ways. We could be far more superior if we were living by the distributive government. The reason why we're struggling is because of the government controls and its design. Its efforts are to destroy us. Anyway, let me resume here. So the final little clause here of the 17th Amendment is, this amendment shall not be so construed as to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as part of the Constitution. So in other words, everybody that's in office as senators will be able to maintain their seats, but when their seat comes to a fruition or to an end of its term, when a senator ends their term, they will no longer be chosen by the state legislature if this Constitution becomes valid. And so the real disconnect, as I told you before, the real disconnect comes in Article 5 of the Constitution. And so Article 5 is about as clear as bell, and it's right here in the Amendment Protection Clause. And this is what it says. Provided that no amendment which shall be made, that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. So in other words, many people out there, and I've talked to constitutionalists, you know, and I don't even want to name names. These guys are hardcore conservative, you know, I look at patriots, you know, what these people say, and they go, oh, this is great. And I'm going, no, this is wrong. The 17th Amendment does not, because this line still exists. The only way a state that rejected the 17th Amendment would be forced into having their election, you know, of the senators take over the seating of their senators, the only way that could have happened by this amendment was the rewriting of this portion of Article 5. So in other words, Utah and six other states, I think Georgia is one of them, but if you go through the list, there's six other states, and I've got an article on this. All seven of these states do not have to abide by this process because they never gave their consent. If you want to really slap the federal government in the face, or I should say the progressives in the face, what these states should do is when this term comes up, the state legislature should then go into session and choose who is going to represent that state legislature in the Senate and push that issue. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that this will go to the Supreme Court. But what this will do is it will bring the argument to the American people to where the people go, wow, okay, this is awesome. Here's the one part that you haven't heard, or for those of you who have not heard and listened to this show on a regular basis, We have an article called Rescinding of the 17th Amendment. There's so many people out there that says we've got to repeal this. We've got to repeal this. That's because they don't understand that in 2010, the federal government opened the door for states to change, formally change their position on the ratification of the 17th Amendment. When they allowed Delaware this opportunity to change, formally change their vote or their rejection of the 17th Amendment and then ratify it now because of Biden and the pressure Biden gave, and the, I'll just say, Biden helped make the way. So the Dalton chief did something that he had no idea he was doing. And so now he made it so that we could take the Senate back, because that's what an idiot he is, because he obviously didn't understand what he was doing in trying to prove that Delaware was a progressive state. Well, maybe he actually didn't understand that there are some real conservative states that don't like this amendment. Oklahoma has been one. Texas has been another. Wyoming is another. Possibly South Dakota, so forth and so on. And so my point is this. It wouldn't take long, because if you've got seven states, how many does it take to get to 13? It only takes six. In other words, we could overturn and rescind, not repeal. It would just vaporize. It would be a gap between the 16th Amendment and the 18th Amendment, because the 17th would no longer be ratified. Now, what would they do? Would they change all the numbers? That just messes everybody up, right? But they, you know, I think that's a good problem to have, though, don't you? And I think that we need to push this issue. As I was talking, and I'll get into this a little bit later, I had a conversation with the, I think it's the FRA, it is the Financial Reform Act or something like that. These guys are, you know, trying to pursue a constitutional convention, an Article 5 convention, and amending the Constitution and so forth. And it's actually a small organization. And so I'm not going to, you know, get into the weeds on this, but I'm hoping that I can have some really good, honest conversations with these folks. Because truly, if we all agree what the problem is, and then we all should agree with how to solve the problem, the best way to solve the problem. And so let me move on so that we can dive into the, let me see here, the 18th Amendment. Now, this is interesting. After, so what this did was this actually opened the door for federal intrusion into the production world, and it allowed the federal government to, and the federal government actually made a lot of assumptions because of this one amendment. And we'll get into that tomorrow. But what this did was it actually created a new law, a crime that the federal government had jurisdiction over. And that crime was the manufacturing and the selling of distilled liquors. So this is the Prohibition Amendment. It was proposed in 1917 and ratified in 1919. After 1 year from the ratification of this article, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors within the importation thereof into or the exportation thereof from the United States and all territory subject to the jurisdiction thereof for beverage purposes is hereby prohibited. The Congress and the several states shall have concurrent power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. But there's a final section coming up. So when we come back, we'll get into that final section. So stay tuned, and then we'll clip right into the 19th Amendment after this. We'll be right back after these two promos.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so the 19th Amendment, it's pretty short, it's pretty sweet, and this also affirms a standard that has never changed as far as our government and the Constitution regarding elections and who can vote. The right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. So we've seen that they've done away with now the right to vote by abridging your right because of poll taxes or any kind of burden. Then what they did was they basically alleviated the ability for the states to use racial laws and or basically denying very specific people from being able to vote. So in other words, they've really moved the Constitution, and this is kind of a testament. Why didn't they get it right the first time? Is it something that was really required gradually? Did they not know and did they not understand back in the 1800s the role, probably more so than we do today, the role of a member of the militia? And based on the standards, the militia actually was at a pretty young age. But we kind of have come to at least a grip with, if you are old enough to die for your country, you should be old enough to actually vote. And so they were still apprehensive because this concept of being a property owner and understanding the nuances of maintaining the sovereignty and control of your property, they still felt that that was necessary, that it was just way too young for a person to understand, you know, taxation of property, and what it takes to be a responsible property owner, which is why they, you know, kind of kept it from going down to that age. Maybe what they should have done was they should have actually made the ages of service at that age as well, because there is a conflict. If somebody truly can die for, you know, their country, and supporting the Constitution, then they should at least at that point deserve representation. Now, the progressives today want to take the voting age down to 16, and I think that's ridiculous. I think the age of 17 is ridiculous as well, as far as serving the country. I think that a person should be able to pull a trigger and so forth, and that may be a ready reserve that the country can actually use as a temporary need, but we have plenty of people. I think that they need to adjust the age for the militia service to probably 19 or 20. I think that some of the kids coming into the military today, lack some, life lessons that they need before they get into the military. The problem is that the progressives want to be able to keep, your children in their train, in their track. In other words, while they're in the education system, they're on track by the government of being indoctrinated the way they want them to be indoctrinated. And then going straight into the military, from high school into the military, is a perfect track to actually get them fully on board, because the United States military is the perfect form of communism. And I mean that because it is voluntary. You aren't compelled. This is a voluntary service. And so I believe that a child should be forced to work for themselves, to figure out what it takes to be successful before they're allowed to go in. And I think that 2-year gap is crucial. Graduating from high school and then trying to go out and make it on your own and be successful or not. I mean, how successful can you be in 2 years? I just think that it's like a cooling off period as well. It's a maturing. It's a process, actually, in metal refining, because you have to let the metal rest. You have to let the metal actually come to a cool and natural state before you can, work on hardening it, edging it, and those types of things. And so I believe we're making a big mistake by allowing, 18-year-olds to vote. And I think it should actually be moved to the age of 20. And I think that we could probably create plenty of studies to prove the more mature somebody is, the better they are. Because today, people don't even think. As a matter of fact, the reality, and I think one of the studies will come in, that you will probably, it'll probably be proven that when an 18-year-old gets the opportunity to vote, then they vote. And they'll vote for the first election, maybe the second election, but then they stop voting for a little while, unless they maintain political activity. And so what ends up happening is they kind of cool off. They don't vote for a little while. And then they actually start learning some lessons. And from based on those lessons, they go, you know what? I really do need to vote. And this is where, and this everybody understands this, this is where people convert from being a flaming liberal to becoming an actual conservative, because they realize that, hey, it took me a lot to earn my car and to earn my, this little house that I'm buying. And now you want to tax it? It seems like, you're sucking blood out of me. And that's when people start waking up and going, government shouldn't be, this involved in our lives. It should not need that much money. And all they're doing is creating a culture of people, with their hands out, greedy, wanting to take more and more from us. In other words, they want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg, because what'll happen is when the makers can't make enough for the takers, then it all collapses. And the government, this is just another way to show that the government is waging a class warfare on the American people. There's a cultural warfare that's going on because of that open border. There's an economic warfare in so many different ways in America that they're waging. They're attacking you, the American, And I'm not talking about the Constitution. These evildoers in office, these public servants who are violating their oath of office, are attacking you in such a sophisticated way that nobody recognizes the fact that we have been engaged in a class of war that, you know, even the books don't even describe. And to me, this is a just sad day when people can't recognize what the heck is going on and why they're under assault. Anyway, let's go into the next amendment, which was not ratified. This amendment was actually proposed in 1926. And listen to this. This was under Calvin Coolidge's watch, right? Section 1, the Congress shall have the power to limit, regulate, and prohibit the labor of persons under 18 years of age. The power of the several states is unimpaired by this article, except that the operation of the state laws shall be suspended to the extent necessary to give effect to legislation enacted by the Congress. In other words, the whole point of Calvin Coolidge and this campaign on this very particular issue was to keep children from being engaged in labor, that they wanted to remove children from the labor force. Well, I told you that it has been a model in America and in the world that businesses were the family, whether it be the production of eggs, whether it be the making of baskets, whatever. Children started actually contributing to the family business as soon as they were mature enough and able by the parents, whether that was milking of the cows, whatever it was. They started them at a young and early age because this is where, you know, we started teaching one of the most valuable lessons of being productive. Go look at this time and age in 1926 and how many people had their hands out for government assistance and government welfare. As a matter of fact, I believe it was Lyndon B. Johnson that pointed to this era in 1926 where they looked at the demographics, and he basically said, at this point in time, America, by the races, and I've got this in my first book, that by the races themselves, we were equal. In other words, both the blacks and the whites in America were amply educated, amply employed, and so forth. What had to happen was we had to have such a severe downturn in the economy to allow racism to creep in to basically, because what ends up happening is when all of a sudden things are going, we have hard times befall us, then what we have to do is we have to, you know, figure out who can suffer, and those who are different suffer the most. And then all of a sudden, the government to create, this opened the door for the government to create projects and all sorts, you know, like the Negro Project, like the housing projects and so forth. We can get into all of that, but we're really trying to cover the Constitution. So when we come back, we'll get into the 20th Amendment. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org.
www.takeactionpodcast.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.